Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, we have a special guest coming in via Skype from Toronto. I'm pleased to welcome Professor Joseph Heath. He's a professor in the Department of Philosophy and also the School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Toronto, and he's the director of the Center for Ethics at the University of Toronto. Joseph Heath has published several academic books and many papers, and also some great popular books, including The Rebel Cell, co-authored with Andrew Potter, The Efficient Society, and most recently in the book that we're going to focus on today, Filthy Lucre, Economics for People Who Hate Capitalism. Now, that's the Canadian title of the book. The title, as it was repackaged for Americans, is Economics Without Illusions, Debunking the Myths of Modern Capitalism, which is a somewhat different slant, Joe, than the Canadian title.
I know, you can thank Random House for that.
You can thank
Random House and Borders for that.
Huh, do you know what the logic... I'm just curious, what was the logic behind...
They were happy to go with Filthy Lucre, but the subtitle, Economics for People Who Hate Capitalism, in Canada, that's a very large market segment.
Yeah, that was my hunch.
And Random House thought that you know, maybe the capitalism haters were too small a market segment in the United States. So I was resigned to the subtitle being dead in the water.
They should just sell the Filthy Lucre titled books in like San Francisco, Berkeley, you know, Cambridge, and Portland.
They were totally happy with Filthy Lucre. They'd done up the cover, they'd done the artwork, they'd done everything, absolutely everything. And then they were someone in sales was talking to the buyer for Borders. And the buyer for Borders said, "What does lucre mean?"
Oh, that's another problem, I guess. We Americans aren't as sophisticated as you Canadians.
Well,
we don't know
panic
lucre.
Panic broke out in the halls of Random House. You know, everything had to be redone because the buyer for Borders didn't know what lucre meant. And I said, you know, like filthy lucre, like in the Bible. Aren't you like a biblical nation, you know?
No, you don't understand. We haven't actually read it. We just believe it.
That's right.
It's a difference.
I actually pushed back. I wrote them a big, long memo about how they could, you know, how filthy lucre is commonly used expression in the Bible. But no, they turfed it. So there you go. Economics Without Illusions.
I see. So it's a great book. I'm actually not done with it. I'm only in the middle of it. But would you say that it is more critical? I mean, it debunks myths both from the right and from the left. Would you say that it was actually intended more as a critique for an audience of left-wing readers?
So if you only got halfway through it, so you read the critique of right-wing fallacies and haven't got to the critique of left-wing fallacies.
Well, no, I don't read linearly, don't worry.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's good then. No, it is intended for people who hate capitalism. It's not necessarily written by somebody. It's more written by somebody who used to hate capitalism. But it is for a left-wing audience. And the people I want to reach are people sort of like myself who maybe had some interest in economics, but were so turned off by the way that it's typically taught that they didn't sort of pursue the matter. And so, like, I had that experience of going to an economics class, and when you first learn about they introduce a few assumptions, everybody's self-interested, corporations seek profits, and everything about that is okay. I just sort of instinctively thought, well, this is just right-wing ideology, and I don't have to pay attention to it. So, you know, I went to a couple classes, and then that was it.
So how did you learn about economics if you dropped
out? I didn't go back to class because I didn't really like it, but it was just a multiple choice test. So I read the book on my own and passed the test.
That's why I keep telling most of my students that they can do that. Don't bother coming to class unless you don't.
I actually stuck out my hand in class, and I said to the professor when he said it was going to be a multiple choice test, generated by software that came with the book.
Oh, wow.
Like there was a CD that came with the book. And I said, does that mean that nothing you say in class that's not in the book could be on the test? And he was like, that's right. And I said, okay, I'm out of here. But I guess the most important thing was that I never took anything beyond Economics 101. And so I never learned the more sophisticated and nuanced models that you get taught in upper year economics. And so what happened was just like very, very much later in life, I came around to the realization that there's a lot more going on there and that it actually, you know, economists have all kinds of interesting insights and useful ways of thinking about the world. So I wound up kind of self-teaching a lot of economics. And the idea, but I was sort of driven by a set of moral and social justice concerns. And what I found was that economics actually addresses all of these concerns eventually. You just have to stick with it.
Not at the 101 level, you mean?
Not at the 101 level, yeah. So right. What I thought I'd do is put together a book where the moral concerns were front and center. Those get addressed directly. But what I first wanted to do was sort of convince my sort of broadly liberal left audience that economics is not just right-wing ideology. So the point of starting with the six favorite economic fallacies of the right is to show that it does actually cut both ways, like it's a neutral framework. And that while it does undermine some sort of treasured left-wing views, it also undermines a lot of right-wing arguments. So, for example, I sort of make hay with the idea that tax cuts can stimulate the economy, which, strictly speaking, is not the case, and it doesn't take very sophisticated economic reasoning to see why they can't. So the idea is to sort of gore some sacred cows of the right at first in order to kind of, you know, persuade the audience that this is worth paying attention to.
And what is an example of the second half of a myth or an assumption that is typically made by the left that you think it's actually not valid?
Yeah, pick the most important one, please.
Oh, the most important
one. Yeah.
A long time since I wrote this book. but I would say, you know, one that's really persistent, and it comes up in Canada where, you know, we have active left-wing parties who actually get elected to the opposition, at least. but for example, one of the things I try to persuade people is that the left has this very strong impulse to want to fiddle with prices as a way of trying to achieve social justice objectives. And so in the particular, I mean, in the book, I criticize the fact that in Canada, governments often subsidize electricity. And the left is sort of the major proponent of this. And then in the last federal election and now provincially, the NDP, which is our sort of social democratic left party in Canada, is really, really keen on giving people tax exemptions, VAT exemptions on home heating. And so heating oil, electricity, and that kind of stuff. While simultaneously endorsing all kinds of environmental plans to motivate people to get geothermal heating and stuff like that, they also want to reduce the cost of using fossil fuel to heat your home. And if you ask people why they want to do it, the answer is always, oh, because the poor, because they can't afford their heat. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that you can fairly easily pick apart, where you can show that, look, fiddling with the price is one way of addressing the problem that the poor have. Another way would be to keep the prices the same and to give the poor income supplements, which would allow them to pay their, or give them a voucher or do whatever, right? But let the prices reflect the social cost of the good in question. And I mean, it's a kind of simple exercise, but it's kind of say, look, I mean, and so I actually run the numbers on electricity and I show how much a poor household in Canada on average consumes of electricity and how much a wealthy household in Canada consumes for electricity. The problem with subsidizing electricity to try to help the poor is that you help the rich too. You give everybody cheap electricity. And in fact, you know, the average rich family gets, you know, $3 for every $1 that the poor gets with electrical subsidies. And it encourages overconsumption, which is destructive from environmental reasons. So it's not a rocket science. Like, it's a terrible, terrible policy to want to promote social justice in the kind of distributive justice sense by giving people like cheap power or subsidizing their home heating oil or that kind of thing. But it's a very, very powerful impulse on the left.
Right. But so the example you just described, I think, makes particularly clear something that I often have a hard time getting through when I'm involved in discussions about economics and ethics, which is that you know, economics is about, it's fundamentally about how to achieve certain goals. And the goals are in part at least set not just by the economic realities, not just by the number crunching and so on and so forth, but also by whatever it is that the values that you want to promote. That is, there has to be a symbiosis, there has to be a relationship between, so the factual analysis, the okay, this is going to work or this is not going to work, and whatever values are going to inform what it is that you want to achieve through economic means, right? So, but too often people seem to think that the two are completely, in fact, decoupled, that there is something intrinsic about the way, you know, about economics that is essentially value-free, or if you ask a right-wing person that is inherently supportive of their own values. That is simply not the case. You could come up with very different economic solutions to a particular problem, depending on whether you give a priority to a particular kind of value or another. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, in my first popular book, The Efficient Society, I actually sort of dissect that a lot, because in particular, I look at the goal of efficiency, mm-hmm. And which is typically portrayed. I mean, less so now, but so when I was young, and in this famous economics class that I attended a couple lectures of, I quote my undergraduate textbook from back in the 80s that explicitly said that economists are concerned about efficiency, by which they meant Pareto efficiency, and that is an entirely technical and value-free notion.
Right.
Whereas the other people are concerned about distributive justice. And that, because it's win-lose, is a value, and therefore is subjective, and is outside the province of economics. And that's like, if you look at
Can you just explain what Pareto efficiency is for people?
Right. And so one of the things I do in the Efficient Society is kind of try to explain how that economic concept of efficiency, Pareto efficiency, is different from, like, you know, how efficient your washing machine is. Because even how efficient your washing machine is not a totally value-free notion. But Pareto efficiency is explicitly moral. What it says is that from the standpoint of society, if you can improve one person's condition without worsening anyone else's condition, then from the standpoint of society, that arrangement is better. So it's a kind of like no harm principle, which says that, you know, if you can change things in such a way that nobody is hurt, then that's good. You should do it. So there's the Pareto efficiency standard. And that's really central to the market and to the various proofs about the desirability of markets, is that they show that they're efficient in that Pareto sense. And so back in the darker ages of economics, it was thought that that was purely technical. I actually checked back at my undergraduate economics textbook 10 years later, and they'd actually changed that section. And it was kind of an interesting and heartening example of the influence of John Rawls, where they kind of said, you know, it used to be thought that there was this huge difference between efficiency and fairness, whereas John Rawls has shown that a theory of justice can incorporate distributive considerations. And it's actually true. I mean, Rawls actually did have a significant effect in making people realize that that principle of efficiency was a principle of justice as well, and that distributive justice was not so exotic when compared to efficiency, that you could use a lot of the same apparatus to think about fairness the same way you think about, you know, how to improve people's welfare. I actually would like to think that this is changing a little bit, that people are becoming more aware of the fact that there are these explicitly moral commitments underlying a lot of welfare economics.
Joe, how much of disagreements between, for example, the right and the left over what the ideal economic arrangement, economic policies would be, how much of that do you think is due to people just having different ideas about what the facts are, and how much of it comes down to just values, what kind of society they prefer? Like, if everyone were made to have a completely clear and accurate understanding of what the facts actually are, how much disagreement do you think would be left?
Right. I think that the United States is significantly different from Canada in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in the States for 5 years, and I actually think that in the United States there are something much more closely resembling genuine disagreements over values, particularly mm-hmm. the way in which Americans privilege liberty. So if you take a doctrine like libertarianism, and so the view that the way you should be thinking about economic relations is in terms of individuals' liberty and their property rights and so forth. A lot of people who've done some, you know, dabbled a little bit with the libertarian stuff, but also done some economics, have this view that says that not only is it best for individuals to have these totally autonomous property rights and so forth, but also in a market economy, if everybody does this and everybody respects property rights, that everybody is going to be happier.
Right.
But if you run a thought experiment where you have a kind of welfarist commitment that this is going to make everybody happy, and then you have a more sort of principled rights-based commitment that says this is also the best system of individual liberty. But then, and everybody imagines that those two are going to, for the most part, be compatible. But if you imaginatively kind of separate them and say, okay, well, what happens in these cases where you could make everyone happier by violating some rights here and there? When you introduce that break, most Canadian, quote, libertarians will cave. Mm. Because really, they're just concerned about welfare. They're not bona fide libertarians. And, you know, push comes to shove, they'll violate property rights or whatever if they think it's going to promote general welfare. Whereas there actually, I think in the United States, there are a substantial population of genuine libertarians who would actually be willing to sort of, you know, have everybody suffer in order to make sure that individual freedom and rights are respected. I sort of came to that view when I lived in the States during the, when Bill Clinton was first elected and during the debates over the Clinton attempts to reform healthcare. And at the time, it was a much more kind of open debate because people hadn't been through it all the time. And a lot of, I was always pay attention to when Canada would come up and Canada's single payer model of health insurance would come up. And yeah, I just remember once listening to an NPR program where everybody who was on the program agreed that, yeah, single payer would be best. But then someone said, but fundamentally, Americans will not wait in line for healthcare. And then everybody on the program kind of just caved. They were like, you're right. You can't do it here. And I thought, wow, that's really different than in Canada. So I actually think that, you know, and part of the reason my book, The Official Society, was kind of about Canada. And it was arguing that a lot of the reason that things work in Canada is a kind of pragmatism about how you implement things and an overarching commitment to efficiency. But that's actually not a good characterization of the United States, where I think there is actually a genuine commitment to liberty. And so the disagreements that exist in the States are not just over facts or over means, but there are different, you know, real values at stake.
But I wanted to go back, however, to a broader perspective with which you actually start the book. You make an interesting claim, according to my notes at least, at the beginning of the book, which is that after... a period of experimenting with different, radically different ideas about what kind of society we might want to implement, we now got to the point where we pretty much seem to agree that there is only one thing that is going to work, and that's some version of the social democratic control capitalistic society, that there are no other big ideas at play at the moment. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I have some sympathy for Francis Fukuyama. I think that people were unfairly mean to him because, you know, the way he defended himself, you know, against, so he declares the end of history. He says, right, yeah, capitalism and, you know, social democracy, or not even social, but just kind of liberal democracy, is the end of history. We've run out of ideas. And I mean, of course, notoriously, Daniel Bell declared the same thing in the, what, late 50s with the end of ideology, like just before the most intensely ideological period of American history. So, you know, bad timing is easy to achieve in these areas. But so Fukuyama declares the end of history on the grounds that people have run out of ideas. And then everybody, you know, got upset about that. They said, oh, no, look at this. There are all these people. Look at these, you know, like, you know, Muslim theocrats and all this kind of stuff. And one of the ways in which he defended himself was by saying, yeah, but look, you know, of all the people who criticized my book, pointing to these alternatives to liberal democracy, not one of those people actually endorsed the alternative model.
Right. They're all bad ideas.
That's right. I mean, everyone said, oh, look, but look at these people over here. Look at Pakistan. They're doing it totally differently. But nobody was endorsing that model. And he did sort of have a point that if you went back to the 70s and looked at, you know, there were lots of domestic critics of liberal democracy and capitalism, lots of Marxists all over the place, who would not only criticize an end of history thesis, would be actively endorsing some other model of how to organize society. So I think that it's not actually crazy what he said, and that people have sort of run out of ideas. And at one point I kind of provocatively said, or challenged people to explain what the difference is between what Fukuyama called the end of history and what Jürgen Habermas called the exhaustion of utopian energies. And, I mean, Habermas put it in a kind of, you know, bleaker tone, right? But he's describing the same phenomenon, which is that people have run out of ideas about how to radically transform society in such a way as to improve it. There's been convergence on the issue of markets from broad quarters. I mean, it doesn't mean that, and with democracy, it doesn't mean you can't change lots of things about the system. It's just, right, you're not going to improve things by changing the overall architecture.
Right, but so what that does imply, however, is because you're saying we're not about to change the big architecture, we're just about there is a lot of room within that architecture for change, but the architecture itself seems to be at least at this point fairly fixed. I noticed that you made a reference to the Fabian Society at some point, saying that we're all Fabians now, and this was very funny, right, to me, because I ran into the Fabian Society just a few days ago because I'm reading a fictionalized biography of H.G. Wells, who was, of course, one of the major exponents of the Fabian Society. So Now, the Fabians, who still exist, they are still very active in England, and it's a society that started out with socialist ideas, pretty much, right? And but their their principle from the beginning was exactly what you're saying. That is, we're not gonna tear down the system and replace it with something completely new. We can achieve progress by changing things little by little and tweaking with the system. That was the whole philosophy, right?
Yeah, and actually, there's a kind of interesting story to be told someday that hopefully someone will tell about the influence of Fabianism in Canada, because up until recently, the sort of elite in this country were all educated in England because of Commonwealth scholarships and so forth. And so there was an entire generation of political leadership of Canada came out of the sort of Oxford, Cambridge sort of mill, and many were exposed to and attracted to Fabian ideas. And so a lot of sort of Western socialism in Canada, the kind of thing that gave us healthcare and so forth, was actually motivated by people with explicitly Fabian commitments.
I looked up actually that the Fabian Society exists in several other countries, but not in the United States, apparently. There is no American chapter of the Fabian Society that I could find, which I suppose makes sense.
The whole story about the missing left in the States is I mean, complicated and interesting, right?
Yeah. Joe, I'd be curious to hear what some of the major ways that your views have changed as you learned more about economics, or recently. I don't know if your views have changed recently.
Yeah, I have to say, I wrote a paper about this recently about sort of changing, an important change that happened in the 20th century in the way people thought about the invisible hand of the market. Mm-hmm. And the old-fashioned way of presenting the central argument for the market, the sort of Adam Smith way of doing it, mm-hmm. is to present the market as being important because it sort of allows us to economize on moral commitment. It's a motivational argument for the market. So when Adam Smith says, you know, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher and the baker that I get my bread, but rather from their self-interest. The idea is that what's good about the market is that before you have a market economy, people, as it were, have to be kind of socialized into sharing a set of common values and being committed enough to the community that they're willing to bake bread for you or to butcher meat for you and so on. So the market comes along and all of a sudden you don't need as much of that fellow feeling because you can get by with self-interest. So it's basically a motivational argument. And then at the same time, it's coupled with a model which is based upon psychological assumptions that are obviously unrealistic and that completely overstate how self-interested people are. And so within that sort of Smithian classical framework of thinking about the market, it's easy to regard the whole thing as being completely mistaken. Now, I think one of the big things that happens in the 20th century in economics that Hayek is ultimately responsible for, but actually, I mean, wound up changing my mind in a significant way, not by reading Hayek, but the kind of repercussions of this argument, is a move away from this focus on motivation towards a focus on information. And this is also something that came out of the difficulty experienced in the Soviet Union and the whole communist experiment with doing away with the market, is that what comes to seem really important about the market and the invisible hand is not the fact that it motivates people to, you know, be productive and so forth, but rather it's that the price system reveals information about the relative scarcity of resources, the relative, you know, demand, the relative need and so forth. And it allows you to kind of communicate that information between consumers and producers in a fully decentralized way. And if you were to try to replace the market or get rid of the market, and this is, of course, what was discovered in the, you know, former communist bloc, was that you can't do without prices. And so even if you want a planet economy, you have to have a number that in effect reflects the relative scarcity, you know, relative to supply and demand. And so you need to have a system of prices. And so in the Soviet Union, they used to try to, you know, they used to calculate prices. And of course, as soon as you start calculating prices manually, you start discovering how amazing the market is and how difficult it is to reproduce its central function. That's a real game changer. That really sort of changes the way in which you think about the markets. Entirely, when you start thinking entirely in terms of like providing information, and if you're not getting that information from the market, where else are you going to get it? And that's what's actually, over the course of the 20th century, changed a lot of people's mind about the necessity and desirability of the market. I mean, that's what changed Habermas's mind and lots of other people.
I want to bring you to your second chapter where you talk about incentives. And you seem to make a case for the idea that, yes, incentives may be important for changing human behavior, but they may be overestimated, especially in certain political quarters. They're not all that they crack up to be. What is that based on?
That actually touches a little bit on my academic work. So my more academic work is actually trying to figure out how you can model rule following within a formal model of action. So how you can modify an economic model of action to incorporate rules. And that chapter is kind of just a gloss on it. But I mean, it's just this crushingly obvious feature of human motivation, which is that, you know, people follow rules. You know, sometimes out of laziness, but I mean, because they can't be bothered to calculate the consequences of their actions. But often because they have a commitment to the rules, and in particular moral rules, so they don't want to lie, they don't want to cheat, and so forth. This is one point I say, that's why there's no such thing as a rational choice criminologist. Because if... and there actually are rational choice criminologists, but if you look at their models, they're not actually rational choice models. Because if people actually reason the way economists say people reason or think people should reason, that nobody would ever respect the law because there are tons of profitable opportunities to violate the law right, left, and center. That's why actually the one area where economists have actually thought about the law is in the area of tax compliance. And again, the economic models are absolutely useless because if you look at tax compliance, there's no reason why the overwhelming majority of the population should comply with tax law. So people follow rules, and even when they could easily get away with breaking them. And that's sometimes economically significant, sometimes not. One of the characteristics of markets is that we explicitly designate them as sort of competitive environments where you're not expected to behave in a pro-social way because we want to elicit competition from people. So we've kind of patterned the interaction as one where you're not supposed to follow rules. And so, of course, in those situations, you can find more self-interested behavior. But that's because, like, we in a football game, you can find self-interested behavior on the part of one team, right? On the one hand, incentives are incredibly important, but they're not everything. And so any kind of economic model that thinks you can ignore morality or rule following is going to be, you know, inadequate. And yet at the same time, so you can't take it and say, aha, therefore economists are wrong, therefore we can avoid incentives, because right. You know, that will definitely come back and bite you. The fact is people follow rules, but they have an eye on opportunities for defection. And even if a lot of people will spontaneously break rules, when they see other people breaking rules, they'll start to break them. That's why, you know, people start looting and stuff like that, and it can kind of snowball, because when you see other people not respecting the rule, that everybody's, that gives you license to break it yourself. So you definitely ignore incentives at your peril, but that doesn't mean that you know they're everything.
That's very well put. I was wondering about your position on the roles of government and the market in terms of providing goods and services. Whether there are certain things that you think that the market is much better equipped than government to provide, and vice versa. I mean, I know there's some standard answers to this, but if there are things that you think don't get enough of a hearing, I'd be curious to hear.
Enough play?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a little shtick about insurance, and some of it's in the book, some of it's in my other work, but I actually think insurance is really, really important. And in fact, there is a sort of common view of the welfare state on the left that I think is mistaken, which is that people tend to think of the welfare state as being primarily redistributive in its function. Mm-hmm. And so they have a picture, like if you think of, you know, kind of Rawlsian framework, we have two principles of justice, efficiency, which says sort of how much we should produce, mm-hmm. and then equality, which says who should get what.
Right.
There's a tendency to want to map those two principles onto the two institutions and to think that the market, therefore, is in the business of promoting efficiency. And then, but the problem is it makes really unequal outcomes. And so the state comes in and just redistributes. And that those are the two complementary roles of the market and the state. I actually think that's really, really mistaken. For the most part, the state's involved in the same efficiency-promoting exercise as the market. It's just that a lot of the efficiency-promoting public goods that the state provides look like they're redistributive because, in fact, they're insurance products. Right? So the classic example would be Social Security, which often gets classified in discussions as a redistributive social program, and often political philosophers that I work with, you know, will try to justify it on egalitarian grounds.
Right.
But it's really not about redistributing, as witnessed by the fact that it's not particularly progressive, like the pension component of it. Really what it is a collectively provided life annuity, which is essentially an insurance product, right? So, you can go and buy life annuities privately. So you plunk down $1,000, and in return, you get this promise that from, say, age 65 until you die, you'll get a certain amount of money per month, right? So that's an annuity. If you try to go and buy those privately as an individual, you'll get a really bad price. And if you go as a woman and try to buy it, you'll get a really high price because women are more likely to live longer than men. So that's a typical source of failure of insurance markets called adverse selection, is that only people who think they're going to live for a long time are going to buy these things. And so they're going to be priced to reflect that.
Right.
So there's always advantages to be had from purchasing these things as groups. You can get a better price, which is why often employees or employers will provide a defined benefit pension scheme, mm-hmm. which is basically a collectively purchased life annuity. But the Social Security system in the United States is basically a gigantically collectively purchased life annuity scheme. So it redistributes, but only because it's an insurance scheme. And if you look at the real redistribution that goes on with any of these kinds of schemes, the people who really benefit are the people who live to be 100. The redistribution actually runs from people who die young to people who die old.
Right. From rich to poor. Yeah.
Not from rich to poor. And, well, only accidentally, insofar as the rich tend to live longer than the poor.
Exactly.
Right? And so if anything, there's actually, in fact, one of the things that makes Social Security, the pension benefit, less progressive is the fact that the poor tend to die younger and therefore subsidize the life of the rich. But all of these annuities, the reason you buy an annuity is that you're worried about outliving your savings. And so what you do is, of course, you don't know exactly how long you're going to live, but if you get together and pool your savings with 10 friends, chances are you'll be closer to the mean. Some people die young, some people die old. Those who die young effectively pay for those who die old. So an annuity is an insurance arrangement whereby you essentially pool your retirement savings. The transfer runs, therefore, from the people who die young to people who die old. And that's really the major function of Social Security, is to protect people from outliving their savings. And that's the way the redistribution works. But that redistribution follows an insurance logic. It doesn't follow an egalitarian or a kind of social justice-y logic.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Right, but the mere fact that money is going from, I mean, the same way like car insurance is redistributive, right? Redistributes from people who are unlucky and have it redistributes from people who are lucky and don't have accidents to people who are unlucky and do have accidents.
That's right.
All right, but that's an insurance logic. Healthcare is the same way.
Now, a number of months ago, I had this somewhat bizarre experience. After a panel discussion, I found myself at dinner. I wrote about this in the Rationally Speaking blog. I found myself at dinner surrounded by Marxists, real Marxists, you know, people who really think that Marxism is still a very viable option.
I have an emeritus colleague who is, bless his soul, he's a member of the Communist Party of Canada, and has been since before I was born. And the other day I was walking across campus and I saw him sitting at one of those tables handing out newspapers. I was like, wow. That's really being a communist.
So thinking about that experience, sort of brought me to, I believe it's the third chapter in the second part of your book where you say, the one entitled Capitalism is Doomed, Why the System is Unlikely to Collapse. This is one of the myths on the left, or at least on some segments of the left. Because, for instance, I consider myself on the left of the spectrum, but certainly not to the point of those Marxists that I was talking about earlier. But there is a certain number of people on the left, especially the more extreme left, that is absolutely convinced still that, in fact, capitalism is just about around the corner from collapsing, and the new world order, whatever that is going to be, it's around the corner. You don't think that that is the case? Why?
sorry, I don't. Although capitalism certainly does puts on a good show of looking like it's going to collapse.
It's quasi-collapsing from time to time, yes.
I actually, I wrote most of the book before the 2008 financial crisis. And so I had a bunch of stuff in there that was kind of like, oh, relax, capitalism's fine, nothing's going to happen. And then, all hell breaks loose. And I actually got the drafts back for final review about 2 weeks after Lehman Brothers collapsed, and the entire global financial system was on the brink. And so I had a chance to revise it. So I was sort of desperately revising the manuscript as events unfolded. But I was sort of, most of the revisions were like, despite appearances to the contrary, capitalism will not collapse. So I stick by that. There's sort of two observations to be made about it. The first is that, you know, coming out of Marx, there's a mistaken argument, what's called the overproduction fallacy, which suggests that, you know, capitalism contains fundamental contradiction, which is eventually going to lead to its collapse, and that the business cycle is just a kind of manifestation of, or these periodic economic crises are a manifestation of a fundamental contradiction. And the idea is that through the introduction of labor-saving technology, capitalists try to increase their profits, but at the same time decrease total demand for products, and so labor can't buy back its product, and so on. And as a result, you know, over time, you're going to wind up, you know, getting shortfalls of demand. Capitalists increasingly desperate to sell their products, and therefore you'll get the, you know, consumerism and all kinds of vast conspiracies to stimulate new demand and so forth. All of this is based upon a fundamental fallacy, which is, I think, has been clearly diagnosed by Keynes and throughout modern economics. But it still is really influential the left. And I have to say that the number of people after the financial crisis who are coming out of the woodwork, who were saying, aha, I told you so, but not just I told you so, they were trying to show, right? So, I mean, from David Harvey, who did like a really widely watched YouTube on this, to my own colleague here, Richard Florida, all trying to show that this only had the superficial appearance of having been about banking and subprime mortgages and so on and so forth. But really what it was about was labor-saving technology in the factory. You know, as though somehow Fordism was the real cause of the 2008 financial crisis in the States. And it's an absolutely crazy story. Like when you look at the kind of chain of dominoes that has to connect the two up. And anyhow, I mean, it's a crazy story. The fact, but it's actually kind of extraordinary how many academics still believe it.
Well, I know someone who blames it on feminism, so it can get crazier.
Yeah, I mean, well, the Marxist thing was sort of a little more well-developed than that, in the sense that in the late 19th century, people were really groping for an explanation of the business cycle, and this didn't seem like a crazy explanation. But, you know, late 20th century, early 21st century, it is a crazy explanation. But a lot of this is just, you know, people can come up, you know, through the ranks and become university professors without ever taking, like, a serious course in economics. And, you know, understanding what it means for supply to create its own demand.
Right. I have a question I'd really love to get your take on. I'm sure you've heard the accusation that economics, and particularly macroeconomics, just is not at all reliable, that they, you know, they create these models. They can't really do experiments, you know, so they sort of create these models based on the data they already have, but, you know, then they totally fail to predict what's going to happen in the future. Because they just, you know, overfit their models to the past sample. Given that there's so many complicated variables at work interacting with each other when we're talking at the level of societies of entire economies, and given that we have such limited data, how reliable can macroeconomics really hope to be as, you know, a predictive science?
Well, I guess it depends what you're talking about. I mean, economics is a vast discipline. There's lots of people who call themselves economists who do nothing but empirical work. And so, I mean, in macro, I have to say, in the book, I kind of make a joke about, you know, I'm a philosophy professor, right? So who am I to complain about, you know, fitting your model to reality? So I kind of joke about philosophy being the department of data-free speculation. And that,
unencumbered by data.
That's right. And come to think of it, that's something that we have in common with classical microeconomics. So economics is also a little bit like that. I have to say, I mean, I actually do find that there's something sort of philosophical about, you know, sort of classic macroeconomics. I'm thinking Keynes and his immediate successors. In the sense that what the models provide, and I'm not talking about, like, you know, contemporary models, whatever, but these sort of really, really classic models trying to figure out the origins of the business cycle and so forth, what is a liquidity trap, all that. All they are is an exercise in extremely disciplined reflection about the world. Right? I mean, that is, you're just thinking through the consequences of something. So you see something happening out there, which is you have what looks like a shortfall of demand, right? I mean, look in the United States right now. I mean, there's an incredible amount of unused capacity. There's an incredible amount of labor sitting idle. And, you know, and the U.S. government can borrow at 1% or something like that, right? So, like, how is it possible that that transactions that would be obviously mutually beneficial to everybody involved are just not happening, right? There are all these people sitting around. There's all these factories sitting idle. Like, why isn't the United States economy producing at at something closer to you know, maximum capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a puzzle there. And a lot of classic macro is just thinking through and micro is just thinking through in a really, really disciplined way how that could be happening. And so the models to get introduced, and in particular, you know, money is tricky. And I mean, ultimately, the story all hinges upon the role that money plays. And what's wrong with the classical Marxist analysis is that it doesn't understand money correctly. And Keynes's real insight is just to have sort of thought harder and more consistently about the way money works. And so I find working through those models, I get something a lot like philosophical insight. You know, it's not the kind of thing where I'm going to turn around and look for verification of it. I mean, it's verified in the sense that I have a puzzle about the world that now I have a plausible theory. Prior to that, I had no plausible theory to explain why it's happening, and now I have a theory. But I actually find that it's kind of philosophical, though, in the sense that what it provides me with is just insight.
But surely, I mean, you care whether the insight is in fact true, no?
Yeah,
Am I assuming too much?
No, it's kind of explanatory, but kind of in like the gigantic way. I mean, I'm talking about the major achievements of 20th century economics, and Keynes in particular, like having figured out the business cycle so that now you have an account of it, which an account that makes sense, which prior to that, no one's ever been able to provide for. I mean, so I'm not talking about being able to predict the movement of prices here and there, or, you know, when this little bubble is going to pop or what have you, right? That kind of stuff. There are not a lot of people claim that economics is equipped to do that kind of thing, or that it even tries to explain that. I mean, it's more like perennial kinds of questions, but, you know, there have been like 30 recessions, and nobody can figure out why they happen and why they stop when they do stop. And now finally somebody has a theory that accounts for it. I mean, yeah, it's broadly verified as well. I mean, like the big winner out of the last 3 years of economics has been Paul Krugman, right?
Yeah.
Because like pretty much everything he said has been right.
Yeah.
So yeah,
although someone's going to be
verified.
Right. I mean, if enough people make predictions, but not to be too pessimistic, I think Paul Krugman's very smart.
Yeah,
but
he's working off a model though, right? And the people who are working off that model have been more consistently right than wrong. So he looks at the UK and says, you know, expansionary austerity is not going to work. Contractionary policies will be contractionary. And what do you know, 2 years later, you know, they're not expanding. So on all kinds of things, he's been sort of consistently right about the, and, you know, it's, you could think of it as vindicating a model. I'm more inclined to think of it as sort of vindicating a way of thinking about, a way of thinking through economic problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we are just over time for this section of the podcast, so why don't we wrap up and move on to the Rationally Speaking Picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Joseph Heath, for his suggestions.
Okay, and so here's my pick. This is not a very fun pick, but I was trying to think back over books that I've read that I thought were really, really interesting. And seeing as though we've been talking about economics, and in particular economics for the non-specialist, I wanted to recommend Janos Kornai's book called The Socialist System, which is an extremely gigantic book. And a lot of people have heard of it because he very famously introduces this concept of the hard budget constraint in this book. But it's only about 2 pages of the book where he talks about the hard budget constraint, and everybody always cites those 2 pages. But in fact, the whole book, I was really surprised at how enjoyable it was to read. And it's not particularly technical. I mean, you have to know, I mean, it has a lot of economic concepts, but it doesn't have a lot of math in it. I don't think it has any math in it. But yeah, it's just a top to bottom description of how the Soviet Union worked and what worked properly and what didn't work properly. And there's actually very, very few books that explain that to the generally educated reader. And I think part of assessing the market, part of the problem with the market is that we take its performances for granted. And so it's easy to imagine that a lot of things just happen naturally or spontaneously, that people just kind of do stuff, when in fact it's the market doing it for us. And so to really assess capitalism and its virtues and vices, you have to really look seriously at attempts that have been made to do without capitalism. And the Soviet Union was actually just an extraordinary experiment where, like, the depths of human ingenuity that were plumbed in order to develop alternatives to doing things with a market is extraordinary. And Kornai describes how it all works and what didn't work and what did work. And it's incredibly fascinating reading. It's actually, I mean, the Soviet Union was a kind of, in many ways, a sort of monument to human perseverance and labor. And it is a remarkable thing, and it was a failure, but it was an extraordinary failure. So anyhow, it's a good book, The Socialist System by Janos Kornai.
I like the idea of an extraordinary failure.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Sounds great.
Well, learning from failure. Learning from failure is important.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest tonight, Jeff. This is fascinating and really enjoyable. We'll post links to your most recent book and your earlier books and also your pick for today for our listeners' benefit.
Great, thanks.
Great. Have a good night. Bye.
All right.
And Massimo and I would like to remind all of our listeners that the 4th Annual Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, also known as Nexus, is coming up. It'll be on April 21st and 22nd of 2012. We encourage everyone to go to the website nexus.org. That's NECSS.org for more information and to buy tickets. This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.